Hello and welcome to the Cambridge Ukrainian Studies podcast, featuring discussions about Ukrainian culture and society with students, scholars, and artists around the world. I'm Rory Finnan, lecturing Ukrainian Studies. In this podcast, we sit down with Professor Simon Franklin to discuss Kiev and the Rus, the medieval polity from which Ukraine and other East Slavic nations claimed descendancy, and which, at its height, controlled the territorial expanse from the Black Sea to the Baltic Sea, and from the Volga River to the Carpathian Mountains.
Kiev, in part, was a transit point, but it was also a center in its own right. And as a center, it then radiated its influence.
In May 2008, not without a great deal of controversy, a television program called Great Ukrainians, Veliki Ukrainci, revealed the identity of the greatest Ukrainian, or at least according to what purported to be 1.6 million viewer votes. Here are the presenters, Slavik Schuster, speaking in Russian, and Hanna Homanai, speaking in Ukrainian. Yaroslav Mudry, Yaroslav the Wise, the greatest Ukrainian, the program would have us believe, was an early 11th century Grand Prince of Kiev, one of the rulers associated with Rus, the first polity to emerge among the Eastern Slavs. So what was Kiev and the Rus, and why is it important to our study of Ukraine today? To begin to answer this question, we turn to none other than Cambridge's own Professor Simon Franklin, one of the world's foremost authorities on the Rus, head of the School of Arts and Humanities here at Cambridge, and one of the moving forces behind Cambridge Ukrainian Studies. In his scholarship, Professor Franklin has focused particularly on the emergence of Rus. Two of his principal publications are Writing, Society, and Culture in Early Rus, published by Cambridge, and The Sermons and Rhetoric of Kiev and Rus, published by Harvard. Simon Franklin, welcome to the Cambridge Ukrainian Studies podcast.
Thank you.
Simon, our topic today is Kiev and Rus. It's a complex, significant, meaty topic, so we'll just introduce it today for those who don't know much about it. And I'd like to begin with the question, first of all, what is Rus and why Kievan?
The two questions sound very simple, and they have complicated answers, or they have different kinds of answers. The simplest answer, I suppose, is that Rus is the earliest recognizable East Slav polity and civilization. It is the beginning of traceable, continuous history based on a recognizable geographical area and a recognizable cultural set of productions. Beyond that, life gets more complicated. At one level, Rus is a negative definition. That is to say, it is what happened before the Tatar invasions. That's a very long period, from around the mid-9th century to around the mid-13th century. Well, that is a period of great change, which can become obscured because it was a long time ago, and we tend to flatten changes. So there are significantly differing phases in the history of what goes under one name, Rus. At the beginning of that period, if you'd asked anybody in what's now Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, where Rus is or who the Rus are, whatever language you'd been talking to them in, they wouldn't have known what on earth you had in mind. There was no such thing. And the story, the first story, if you like, of the creation of Rus, is the story of something coherent emerging out of nothing, because of course there were things and people there, but we're talking about quite different geographical zones, climatic zones, crops, ways of living, languages and ethnicities over a huge area with no natural links between them. The sense that this is a coherent area is one which arises retrospectively. So the story is for the investigative historian, which is only one kind of historian, is how this enormous and incoherent area with Finnic peoples in the north, with Turkic peoples in the south, with Slavs in the middle, each with its own local economies, productions, exterior relations, different stages of economic and social development and so on, how the force lines linking them emerge, and how eventually they turn themselves into a coherent socio-politico-cultural space, and that takes centuries.
And was Kyiv in particular as a geographic site very instrumental in contributing to an eventual cohesion whenever it did emerge?
Kyiv was very important at certain key periods. Mm. The origins of the city itself are, as all origins, controversial. But I think the point at which it becomes significant outside its own orbit, and one can discuss to what extent there was economic and political development in the Kievan area at what stage, but the point it becomes, so to speak, significant on the global scale or the interregional scale is really due, and this is a controversial statement or can be a controversial statement, is really due to its strategic position linking other centres over a large area, and in particular its position as the southernmost defensible major settlement before one moves out into the steppes. And one of the catalysts for the emergence of these force lines that I was talking about was long-distance trade, and in particular trade which linked the Baltic area with the Black Sea area. In terms of northern cities of Rus, that would be Novgorod, Smolensk. In terms of wider areas, that would be the Baltics, the Vikings. In the south, it was Constantinople. And it is not accident that the principal early major fortified cities of Rus and economic centres are at, if you like, the entrance and the exit of that route, Novgorod in the north and Kyiv in the south. We have very good descriptions dating as early as the 12th century from a Byzantine emperor, Constantine Porphyrogenitus, as to how the Rus boats came down the rivers and foregathered at Kyiv before large-scale expeditions out across the steppes to Constantinople. Now, with this major trade organized, this nodal point in trade, that required, that wasn't just a garage where they parked, so to speak, before setting out. That required an infrastructure, that required settlement, that required repairs, that required logistical support, rations, supplies, that required eventually interactions with the local populations and so on. So Kyiv was a major trading centre as well as a major agricultural centre at this strategically focal point in long-distance trade. Its position on a high bank of the river obviously is imposing and helpful in that way. Kyiv, in part then, was a transit point, but it was also a centre in its own right. And as a centre, it then radiated its influence outwards. And for a period of, I suppose, about 150 years, from the late 10th century to the mid-12th century, Kyiv was unquestionably the strategically the most important, politically the most powerful, economically the most prosperous, dynastically the most coveted city of Slav Eastern Europe. It has, in a later discourse, given its name to the entire period from the mid-9th to the mid-13th century. That's somewhat misleading. The period of Kyiv's unquestioned dominance is that kind of golden age, as it comes to be seen in retrospect, of about 150 years. Then life becomes a little bit more complicated.
Now, we were talking about the rather disparate groups of people that settled in and lived in Rus, and we talked a bit about the importance of the river Dnipro, the Dnieper, to Kyiv and to Rus. And of course, there was a major historical event in 988 with Volodymyr Christianizing or baptizing Rus in one of the tributaries of the Dnipro. What kind of role did Christianity have in terms of this issue of unity, in terms of bringing the areas of Rus together around a common cause or purpose?
There are cynical and practical and ideological and idealistic answers to that question. It's a very important, perhaps the key question in the early cultural history of the Eastern Slavs. And it goes to the heart of how states are formed, because they are formed partly as power structures, but for a successful polity or state What you ideally require is not just a power structure where you get people to do what you want because they're frightened of not doing what you want, but a structure of legitimation, a structure of ideas which persuades people that they do what you want because they ought to, because there is some higher reason for them doing so, because there is a logic to where they are and who they are, because there is a collective identity. So one needs a framework of ideas. Now, establishing a power structure based on commercial and military might in a multi-ethnic population over a very broad area is a very difficult thing to maintain. It was done very successfully by the early leaders of Rus, but there are plenty of examples in history of people who've created very rapidly power structures but not been able to maintain them because they don't have the ideological structure to do so. Actually, the Mongol Empire collapsed under its own weight pretty quickly, at least in its broadest expression. Partly, one might think, because there was no ideological coherence throughout the empire. There is, according to the stories in the chronicles, a sense that Volodymyr was aware of this and was looking for some sort of legitimizing focus, some sort of framework of authority to match power. That is authority, which is not just to do with physical power. And the story in the chronicle has him, first of all, trying a different solution, setting up a pagan pantheon on the hill outside Kiev, bringing together various deities of the various peoples over whom he sought to rule. This didn't work, various reasons. And then looking around at various monotheistic faiths of people around him, and lighting on Christianity. It's a very dramatic and colourful story. And that decision, which was ultimately a successful decision, to make Christianity the official faith of his people, defined the cultural, to some extent, the political affiliation of Rus and its successors for centuries. Now, just because he decided to dunk some people in the river doesn't mean that everybody suddenly starts believing in the Holy Trinity.
Right.
So one has to ask what conversion means. We can't see what it means in terms of belief, apart from in the words of the ideologically charged sources which happen to be conveyed to us, and the people writing those sources have a vested interest in presenting belief. But it's actually not something which figures very highly. It's much more to do, even in the sources themselves, with belonging, with affiliation, with definition, with membership of, if you like, a club. Now we're Christian, what do we do? What do we eat? Who can we marry? How can we dress? How do we bury our dead? What are our rituals? What are the signs by which we recognize each other? What are the forms of moral and spiritual authority that we can set up? So, practical guides to living, practical modes of identity, but also, hugely important, visible signs of identity. Christianity implies a certain kind of public space. You build churches rather than mosques or pagan shrines. Urban space is completely transformed by Christianity in the construction of places such as St. Sophia, or before that, the tithe church of the Mother of God, next to the imperial, next to the prince's palace. And those are then duplicated all around the country. It brings with it a visual culture. It brings with it the culture of icons, a certain kind of representational culture. It brings with it a culture of the making and purveying and displaying of certain types of luxury goods, silver, enamels, fabrics, textiles, and so on. So it is. Its conversion is hugely more than simply believing. It is woven into the fabric of political, social, cultural, economic, architectural, aesthetic, and ideological life in ways which are too numerous to calculate. Fundamentally successfully, and as I say, has shaped the fate of that part of the world for centuries afterwards.
as you say, Volodymyr's influence is profound. One of his sons, Yaroslav, also established legal culture with the Ruska Pravda, which is probably best translated as the Law of Rus. What does this document tell us about, first of all, a connection to the culture of Byzantium, but also perhaps a distinction or difference from it?
You mentioned Byzantium, and quite rightly, but Byzantium, one would want to mention, particularly in the context of the conversion to Christianity, in that one of the questions one needs to ask, the Rus needed to ask themselves, the Rus leaders need to ask themselves, having decided to convert to Christianity, is what does Christianity look like? How do we make ourselves, so to speak, a Christian people? And you do it by following the example of that which already exists. And the model was Byzantium, largely, to create a Christian nation, to create a Christian culture, meant to do it like they do it in Constantinople. It was not slavish imitation. That was simply what one did if one was Christian. The law is slightly different. The Ruska Pravda is not a Byzantine document. It's not a Christian document. And it actually has in its precise provisions more perhaps in common with Northern Europe than with Constantinople. From Constantinople, far larger compilations of rules were taken, rules for life, but they were in the context of church law. Mm. Very, very detailed, huge. Ruska Pravda is a tiny document by comparison, hugely important because it's native, but actually very, very limited in scope. Fascinating because it owes just about nothing to Byzantium. Linguistically, it's one of the earliest documents we have in something close to a local version of the language rather than in High Church Slavonic. It's not in ecclesiastical language. But actually, the version of Ruska Pravda, which is associated with Yaroslav, is limited in its provisions. It's only 3 or 4 pages long, and it's largely to do with regulating behavior among the prince's immediate circle. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody strikes someone else with a sword, or pulls somebody's beard, or kills the prince's stable master, or something like that, it's a rather limited area. And then over the course of the next century and a half, it's a living document. So Ruska Pravda started by Yaroslav, but then added to and developed over the next 150 years, it gradually seeps into far wider areas of life. By the early 12th century, Ruska Pravda includes regulation of the interest rates that you're allowed to charge in the marketplace. It seeps out into society in many, many ways and becomes a far more substantial document. Mm. And what it reflects, to some extent, is the process, if you like, of also of state building. Ruska Pravda reflects the extent to which the prince had control not merely on traditional tribute gathering, that is to say, the kinds of areas of life in which coercion is conventionally and rather crudely applied, but the extent to which the prince's view of the way people should organize their own lives, that is to say, central intervention not merely into things which concern the prince, but the idea that how people treat each other is somehow of state importance, that is law. It reflects that process at the emerging then of a society in which law gradually penetrates into more and more areas of life. But that was also an area in which the church was a hugely important ally to the state, because the church automatically assumes authority over bits of people's lives which the state could never dream of having coercive control over. And in that sense, with the state providing protection and support and material assistance for the church providing moral authority and increasing also social legitimation for the prince, that alliance was fundamental also to the development of the Rus state and culture.
We've been talking quite a bit about the influence and the effect of particular figures in the history of Rus, particularly Volodymyr and Yaroslav. And it may be for certain students that Rus is distant and inaccessible. And social history is a very difficult area, because no matter how proximate or distant the history, it's very difficult to know on our part what people did and how they lived their lives. But what texts perhaps give us a sense of how, let's say, the everyday occurred in Rus?
You're quite right to identify the problem of distance and inaccessibility. And I wouldn't want to pretend that that problem doesn't exist. One is suspicious of attempts to make the other too familiar, and indeed to make the past resemble us too much is dangerous in all sorts of ways. One can either look at the past as a way of explaining ourselves, or one can look at the past as a way of extending ourselves into that which is not us, and that is difficult, and we don't have many sources, and they are by and large limited socially. However, life has become in that respect easier in the last 50 years or so. Until relatively recently in the history of the investigation of such things, we were almost entirely dependent on the kinds of written sources that you get in manuscript repositories. They're there because they come from monastic collections. They represent the rather sophisticated ruminations of a very limited section of the population, principally monks. They're about faith, they're about war, they're written largely by people who, by definition, excluded women from their own company, so they exclude half the population from the significant narratives, and we've simply had to rely on that. What has changed radically over the last 50 years comes from a different part of Rus, from the north, in particular from Novgorod. And it's artificial to view these as distinct countries at that period. It comes from Novgorod not because Novgorod was the only place that produced different sources, but because, as it happens, the circumstances of preservation have been particularly favourable. And the sources I'm talking about are birch bark letters, little scraps of birch bark on which townspeople had scratched messages to each other. And these first started being discovered by archaeologists in the 1950s, particularly in Novgorod, and then gradually over at least a dozen now towns of Rus. But Novgorod, because it has been relatively undisturbed in post-medieval times, the archaeological conditions are good, the ground is sodden, which is actually rather good for the preservation of organic materials, so these scraps survive quite well, and there are particular circumstances which help us date them as well, which are useful. But in the Novgorod birch bark letters, which now number well over 1,000, we see the ephemeral concerns of townspeople, not writing for posterity, not writing for a public, jotting things down for each other. We can see their concerns about money. There are lots of lists of who owes who how much for what. We can see their concerns about litigation. We can see their concerns about their personal lives. We have love letters. Why didn't you come and meet me last Sunday when we agreed? Have I done anything to upset you? We can see their concerns in the family. There's one written by a chap called Yuri to his parents in Novgorod saying, come south to Smolensk, bread's cheaper, sell the house, it's better down here. We see women involved in ordering goods, in commissioning jewellery. I sent you the metal for this necklace 3 months ago, you still haven't sent it back to me, what's going on? So that the day-to-day concerns of everyday life in a town we begin to see through these rather unique, in Europe, not just in Rus, types of source, which are expanding the whole time. So this is not just an area in which there's a closed circle of sources which happen to be those which are in the central archives of manuscripts. Every year, the archaeologists dig up surprises and tell us more things. It's
amazing.
Open and continuously. It's a book which is continuously being written.
Two 12th century texts that have captured our imagination before the discovery of these birch bark texts and after have been The Tale of Bygone Years, Povist Vremennik Lit in Ukrainian, and The Tale of Igor's Campaign, the Slovo Opoko Igoreve. What kind of role have these two texts played in our understanding of Rus, and how have we positioned ourselves relative to them?
You asked the question correctly. How do these texts affect the way that we position ourselves, which is not the same question as as what they actually are or what they tell us. They're two very different types of problem, and I wouldn't want to equate the two texts. Mm-hmm. As far as later perceptions of early Rus concerned, they play equivalent roles to some extent in forming an image of early Rus, but they have actually utterly different scope, basis, and authority. The Tale of Bygone Years, or the Primary Chronicle, is a very substantial text which fills a volume in modern editions. Its textual history is complicated, but there's no doubt that we have something close to a substantial text of a couple of hundred pages, which was put together in roughly the form it survives in early in the 12th century by one or more very conscientious and curious monastic compilers trying to make sense of where the land of the Rus came from, on the basis, like modern historians, of some rather fragmentary and unsatisfactory evidence. So in places they're very speculative, in places they're relying on oral accounts, which may or may not be documentary, in places they're relying on documents that they'd found from Constantinople and are clearly documentary and historically valid. And then for the previous 50 years or so, they're relying on already relatively contemporary accounts. So, but it is in the Primary Chronicle, or the Tale of Bygone Years, that the fundamental narrative of the emergence of Rus from the mid-9th century onwards, that story, that core narrative, remains the core narrative to this day. Mm. To be disagreed with, to be argued with, to be dismissed as fantasy, to be accepted as fact, but somehow one can't get away from it. It has shaped the imagination, the discourse, and is likely to continue to do so. And it because, not merely because it's an interesting, exciting, and conscientious narrative, but because of the fate of that particular compilation in the early 12th century. After the early 12th century, Slav chronicles diverged. Each region had its own tradition of chronicle writing. There's Kievan chronicle, Galician chronicle, Volhynian chronicle, Novgorod chronicle, Vladimir Suzdal chronicle, and so on. But what they have in common is that they almost all start with the same shared narrative. Mm-hmm. That is to say, a Novgorod chronicle talks about developments in Novgorod from the mid-12th century. A Kievan chronicle talks about developments in Kiev from the mid-12th century and so on. But before the mid-12th century, they use what we now call the Primary Chronicle, mm-hmm. the Povestvrem Nikolet, as the shared single narrative. So this, because this has been dispersed throughout the Slav area, this is the foundation of what one might call a national myth of quite different modern nations, because they share the same story. Mm. Now, the truth of that story, whether they ought to share the same story, that's obviously a huge area of discussion. But the importance of the Primary Chronicle in shaping how Rus is still perceived, understood, and enters into consciousness among vast numbers of people across a huge area of Eastern Europe is incalculable. The tale of Ihor's campaign, the Slava o Polku Igorevia, has been, to the modern imagination, as potent a source. But that power is much more recent. It has no... The work itself, it's a lyrical narrative, a celebration, a lament of a defeat of a fairly minor prince of the Chernigov land of Novgorod-Siversk, Ihor Svetoslavich, on a campaign into the steppes against the Polovtsi. And the lyrical dimension of this lament means that it's a work which is not merely a narrative of what happened, it's multidimensional in its implications. It invokes not merely all the rest of the land of the Rus in the present, but in the past as well. It evokes a sense of a once and ideally integrated land of the Rus, which has fallen into decline because the princes of its ruling dynasty are unable to maintain that unity, and hence it's vulnerable to the depredations of the steppe. And that sense of a dirge over a golden age has helped to establish and develop the ideology of that golden age in the post-medieval period, mm-hmm. and what people feel Rus was and should have been. However, there's almost no evidence that this work had any significant ideological resonance beyond its own time in the Middle Ages. Indeed, there's almost no reliable evidence for its continued existence in the Middle Ages, and some would argue there's no reliable evidence for its existence at all. The work was discovered in a single manuscript in the early 1790s. Copies were made of that single manuscript, which purports to have been a 16th century manuscript, so 400 years after the work was written. It was printed. It was recognised as being worthy of printing. A copy was made for Catherine the Great herself. It was printed in 1800. And then the manuscript disappeared, burnt apparently in the fire of Moscow in 1812. So here is a 12th century work which doesn't exist. It's a wonderful field for conspiracy theorists, particularly since the 1790s, when it appeared, was a great time for inventing traditions for medieval forgeries. 18th century saw medieval forgeries in many parts of Europe, including Britain, the Ossianic poems, pseudo-medieval. It's been important, however, and was important at the time, not just for what it might tell us ideologically about the 12th century. It's been important for a modern sense of the dignity of the early past. There has been, among some, depending on one's cultural values, a sense that somehow early Rus culture might be regarded as inferior on a global or even European scale. After all, there was no great classical scholarship, there's no Chaucer, there's no Dante, there's no great tradition of secular and court culture. And suddenly here was something which seemed to be literature, in a sense in which people understood literature to be something which was comparable to the Chanson de Roland, to the Nibelungenlied, something which could be presented as on a European, on a world level, not merely for its themes, but for its imagery, for its style, for its aesthetic complexity, standing out very starkly against the background of what is largely an ecclesiastical culture in what survives. So the Slovo Polko Igrvia, not merely assuming its authenticity, tells us something about early 12th century national dynastic ideology. It has been hugely important as an emblem of the dignity of Rus culture in the post-Rus age.
I'd like to go back to Kyiv for a moment. Many of our listeners may be going there this summer. What sites, what places in the city astound you, fascinate you?
To some extent, I suppose, it's walking inside the hillside in the Monastery of the Caves, and not just at the structures over the top of it, but walking into the caves, seeing the bones of, it's a macabre thought, but seeing the bones of the monks who've lived and died there over nearly 1,000 years.
Very well preserved. Mysteriously so, in many respects.
Some of, well, exactly whose bones which are is another thing which historians might choose to discuss, mm-hmm. but that there are some fairly old bones there is not in dispute. But perhaps more than anything, it's to go into St. Sophia and see two things which are complete contrast, the opposite end of the cultural spectrum in a way. One is obvious, a magnificent church with extraordinary mosaic decorations. In a sense, not Rus decorations, they are Greek, Byzantine mosaics. It is one of the most splendid examples of mid-11th century Byzantine mosaics, Why do I say that? Not to put Rus down, but I mean, all the inscriptions there are written in Greek, and they were certainly made by people hired from Constantinople to do the job. The impression that must have made in the mid-11th century on this hill overlooking the river in the middle of what to most of the world was nowhere, to put this quite extraordinarily luxurious chef d'oeuvre of European mosaic decoration on a scale which allowed for no compromise there, must have, surely God must have blessed that place, so to speak. It was quite extraordinary, and the impression that must have had on the local population, who'd never seen anything remotely like it, was extraordinary. But almost more than that, if one's looking for what sends shivers down the spine, it's something which most people don't see at all in Saint Sophia. It's looking more closely at the walls. And if you look more closely at the walls, you see what you actually see on them. On most walls, sadly, and something we're used to discouraging, and that is graffiti. We think of graffiti as defacing fine objects, which of course it does, and I wouldn't wish to encourage any listeners to scratch their names or little messages on historical monuments. But the graffiti in St. Sophia, or some of the graffiti in St. Sophia, are very early and can be dated to the mid-11th century and beyond. And in the graffiti in St. Sophia, which are almost as varied in their way as the birch bark letters of Novgorod, we have a direct sense of, in a tangible and unmediated way, with the immediate concerns of the people who were standing there, worshipping, bored, fed up, doodling, casual, not controlled by the priests or the princes, but just saying what they felt like saying on the walls of a church. And that's been preserved over 1,000 years, and that, I suppose, is where one gets the most direct kind of time warp into early Rus.
This podcast is part of a larger public program of seminars, exhibitions, and festivals produced by Cambridge Ukrainian Studies, an initiative of the Department of Slavonic Studies at the University of Cambridge. Find out more of what we do at www.cambridgeukrainianstudies.org.uk, or find us on Facebook. Music provided by our friends, the Ukrainians.